I guess I'll start then, guys. Hi, I'm Michael. I'm a grad fellow in Roger's group, working with Lauren and who else is taught here? Just Roger?
Roger.
Is Roger the Bogdan, your reinforcement learning guy in the back. And today I'm going to tell you about, more broadly, probably something that you've heard a little bit about from other people speaking, sort of an introduction, but the idea of generative modeling. And so, Lauren, did you put those notes on the website?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm just gonna go off some notes that I typed up off the website so you can follow along if it's easier for you that way. And so the past few days, I think Roger's been telling you about this one type of generative model, probably in a lot of detail, called a restricted Boltzmann machine, which is a great way to do sort of a deep dive into how one might think about all the things we have to, about how these things work, but there are lots of different forms of those things that have developed over the last 4 or 5 years that today I want to try to introduce you guys to. So I'm probably going to go through a little quick on some parts of it just so we can cover all of them, and I'm going to break it up over 2 days. So there's like about 3 or 4 sections in those notes, and we'll probably do the first 1.5 today. So what do we mean when we say generative modeling? If you guys heard this term so far, you know, how has it been introduced to you guys?
You're trying to learn some probability distribution of your data that you're not given.
Right, yeah, exactly. And it sort of separates itself from discriminative modeling, which you'll see a lot as like a form of regression or class labeling, where we're trying to learn some P of Y, a label or a value given some input data. And now here what we're trying to say is, okay, well, I want to know the distribution that sort of creates both of those things. Where does that data come from? We say we want to learn P of X, Y, and Y, the joint. But in reality, a lot of times, there's no label to go along with our data, and what we really just want to learn is P of X. So this is what we'd call, you know, unsupervised, a lot of the time, generative modeling. And so today I'm going to sort of try to talk to you about those advances that we've seen in those and break them down into some subcategories. So if you look at Ian Goodfellow's NeurIPS tutorial from 2016 on generative adversarial networks, he does a good job sort of breaking down what the space of generative models is, and I'm sort of going to extract some framework from that here and fill in some of the more modern developments since 2016, because this field moves so quickly that there have been many developments since 2016. But first of all, like, why do we want to do generative modeling? And can you all see this? Is it big enough for you?
A little bigger.
A little bigger?
Yeah.
Cool. So a lot of the times, especially as people coming from science backgrounds, one thing we want to do is perform inference on our data. We want some statistical measure of its likelihood or the probability of it, right? So that's something we could get here is exact/variational inference. We have those likelihood measures. We can, once we know this distribution, we can sort of fill holes in our data. If there are parts missing, you might be able to extrapolate to fill in some of the missing information there, which if any of you have seen the work that Katie Bauman did for the Event Horizon Telescope, work, this algorithm that she put this black hole image together, this is sort of an interesting part of that because of how scant and sparse their data is. And so beyond that too, you can sort of start making some super resolved images. How can I try to, you know, embed more information about some base image that I have? And we get sampling. I have these this distributional knowledge, now I want to be able to sample from it. And you can do all sorts of things with sampling. Improve simulations, actually perform your inference, et cetera. So what is this class of models going to look like? Well, I'm going to break them down into three sections. The first I'm going to call ones that we have explicit and tractable likelihood estimates. So this is what I mean by this is we're going to, the point of our model and our algorithm is to try to explicitly describe the likelihood of the data. So out of this, I'll get an exact measure of these probabilities that I want to know about. And so this is going to be broken down into what I'll call autoregressive models, as well as things based on what we'll call normalizing flows. And those would be the two things we'll try to talk about today. Tomorrow, we're going to introduce these explicit but approximate likelihood estimates. Okay, and this is what I mean is we're going to sort of bound some upper or lower limit on this likelihood measure. So whenever I say likelihood or density anything, I'm just referring to, in this case, P of X, okay? So I might be able to put a lower bound on this. I might be able to explicitly describe it. Or, so we'll look at an example of this through the variational autoencoder, which we'll call VAE. Or I'll be working in situations where the purpose of the model is actually not to give me any explicit measure of this, but to become very good at, say, sampling from it. So there's an implicit knowledge about what the distribution is so that I can successfully draw samples from it, some high fidelity samples. So that's what we'll call implicit likelihood. And the thing we'll look at there is it's called a generative adversarial network, or just sort of generally adversarial learning. Okay, so let's start by talking a little bit about, I want to go higher. Can you guys still see that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Today we're going to talk about these explicit likelihood measures. And sort of the go-to for thinking about this type of stuff are these what's called autoregressive models. So the name autoregressive should sort of be a bit self-descriptive. The point is to sort of create some sort of regressive property that looks at data sequentially. Okay, and the way we're going to look at that data sequentially in sort of an autoregressive form is to be able to draw inference on a set of, you know, multi-dimensional data sequentially. So if, in general, we can sort of write down in terms of conditional probabilities, if I have some big multi-dimensional vector x, right, this can be a vector of, you know, n values, I can explicitly say that this factorizes into a product of conditional marginals. So we can break this down according to something along the lines of the probability of the first dimension of my data times the probability of the second given what the first dimension was, say it had a specific value, equaled some little x1, you know, times the probability of the third one given that x1 equaled x1, and x2 equaled x2, et cetera, okay? And so we can describe this whole thing as sort of, you keep the notation the same way I had it in the text. as sort of, you know, a giant product of all these conditional marginal distributions, such that the xi-th component of this vector, the probability of the xi-th component of this vector, is just dependent on all previous. Does that make sense? That's sort of clear. OK, so how do I actually, you know, create some model system where in which I can explicitly factorize the data like this? Well, we'll have to come up with a way of sort of processing data sequentially, but paying attention to where we are in that chain. So a common way that people do this is with a thing called a recurrent neural network, okay, which you can create as an autoregressive explicit density estimator. So the tools that we'll have in this recurrent neural network are some input xi, some hidden state hi, which is going to tell me about where I am on this process, and some RNN unit, which is what I'm just going to call W for now. You'll see a lot of variations about what's actually going on in this. If you read up more about what RNNs are doing, there's a lot of different things you can put in place of Ws to help with, you know, having your gradients be well calculated if you're paying attention to something like the n minus 1th component of this distribution when you need to be aware of what happened all the way back at, you know, the first data that you processed, if this data is very, very multidimensional, like language modeling, which it is often used for. And so we want to sort of set up this recursive data processing algorithm centered around this weight matrix. So I only have one of these, but you'll see that I'll sort of unroll it as we go to sort of describe its process in iteration. So I can say that I initialize my hidden state to some arbitrary vector. It could be all zeros, could be all ones, something, just get it started. And I initialize the input to be a similarly set of all zeros. And I want these to interact with this weight matrix in some way. Okay? So what this process is depends on how you actually go about thinking about what this weight matrix is. And as output of the interaction with this weight matrix, I'll have a hidden state at the first time step, which comes out. I'll make that bigger. And I'll have a probability distribution over the outcomes for what the value of x1 can be, OK? So I'll call it p of a1. So if you imagine, for example, because this is machine learning for quantum many-body physics, that the distribution we're trying to learn is over some measurement outcomes for, say, some spin on a lattice, right? We'll just stick with the simple case here where, you know, a can be the one hot encoded version for 1, 0. So call it a1, 1, just ai1. Or it could be 0, 1, right? This is me just saying there are two class labels, it's either up or down, right? And so I want to learn a probability distribution over those class labels. So, OK, what happens here, right? In the training phase of this, I probably have a giant set of training data, which I'll call x, right? And now I have some probability distribution over what that first value should be, as well a hidden state, which I'm going to use then to feed back into this weight matrix. So in the next step, I'll just say that, OK, this is the same weight matrix, but I'm just trying to write it connectively. We feed in H1. Now I take a sample from my training data, which is an example of a measurement that actually is seen at the first site of this data that I've processed. And I feed that in as the input. So I'm learning some hidden state that goes along with what the samples look like at that first input input space. And I do the same thing, OK? Now what I want is a probability distribution over the second bit of data in my chain. So this will give me distribution over A2. OK? So say we wanted to know the distribution of outcomes over, you know, three spins on a lattice, but they're entangled in some way, so their measurements are sort of correlated. I'd sort of do this one more time. Where now I input something about what's on the second side of the lattice, and I want to get a distribution over the measurement outcomes for the third site. Okay? And so, okay, so each of these might look like something like, I don't know, the first one says 0.7, 0.3, right? Probabilities for the first outcome, probabilities for the second, right? So what the process of training this model looks like to actually get it to start learning these distributions is, okay, I take all this training data that I have to say, well, in one example, what was an actual outcome to this measurement? Let's say in my first set of training examples, this was 1, 0, right? Okay, well, then I'm actually doing pretty decently in terms of the estimation based off this one data point that I have. We would do this for each step in this, right? I would take a real sample from my data and compare it to these probabilities and what the real sample was for the second lattice site, the real sample was for the third lattice site. And I can sort of sum all these things up to write it down as the loss that I'd want to minimize over is this cross-entropy term, okay? Where I would take the sum over all possible class outcomes. In this case, that's just binary, 1, 0, or 0, 1. So in our case, m equals 2. It's not that exciting. So here, well, all I'm saying is that I have some indicator variable y, which says this was the correct class. This was the class that was active, and this was the probability that I associated with that. Okay, so if that probability is very, very close to 1, this loss is going to be just about 0. But if that probability was very close to 0, now I'm just basically trying to collect that term, right, in terms of what its log was, right? And that'll be sort of a very big term then, which will contribute a lot to my loss. So basically, this is sort of an objective function, which is trying to get these probabilities to sit at the correct distribution according to all the outcomes that we have from our training data. So in the end, what I would want to do is take each of these probabilities, right? This is really, I should specify, this is really given, you know, A1 equals X1. Right? This is really given A1 equals X1. A2 equals X2, right? So in the end, as I do this training, these probabilities should really converge to what their two ratios are and should be conditionally dependent on each other, such that when I want to be able to then later sample from this model, I'm not relying on training data anymore. I feed in these initial hidden states and this initial X0, and I get some probability measure. Okay, I can do some Bernoulli sampling from this probability. You know, according to these numbers, I draw a sample. That sample is now what I feed into the next spot of this recurrent network. Get a new probability distribution, sample. The sample is what I feed in rather than the training data. So after you've learned this model, you can now start testing it to say, okay, what is this factorized probability giving me as a sample, and can I do anything useful for it then? Which is nice because if you have some data, I have an exact probability measure of what the giving.
So when do you decide when to sample from your probability distribution that you generated?
When do you decide?
Yeah.
When you've decided your loss has converged enough that the training is no longer necessary,
so
right?
You run it multiple times with your data set.
Yeah. So in this case, if I had three lattice sites, imagine I had some giant data set that was, I don't know, 50,000 examples of those three lattice sites. Right? I guess because this is binary, this would be 50,000 by 3 by 2, right? Yeah, so in that sense then, we have a way of doing some positive things. The advantages of doing this it's a way for me to get a tractable likelihood estimate, no matter what the data is doing, right? And it's trained over some pretty conventional optimization techniques that are well understood, which, as you'll see for some later models, is not necessarily the case. So we'll say that the importance there is its maximum likelihood optimization. And the third being, OK, there's a way for me to sample. But the disadvantage is, OK, what do I do when this isn't three sites, but maybe it's 5,000? And I have to then have to be able to learn some distribution, which is aware of what happened at the first lattice site when it has to make inference about the one, the 4,900th. And so coming up with ways such that the gradients that you get from doing back propagation on this loss function are useful into learning those bits is sort of an active area of research. So the difficulty being, estimation on long sequences. And then the sampling time can be a bit slow because you have to do it sequentially. So in the notes, I go through a bit of a more detailed example of what that would look like and the kind of things we'd want to reconstruct. But for time's sake, I'll just do this here.
This is probably a vague question. I've never used RNNs. But let's say we don't have a 1D chain. We have a 2D chain. Are we required then to pick some spatial sequence of spins to say these guys depend on the previous one and this guy depends on all the previous ones?
Yeah, I mean, you're already doing that, aren't you?
In what way?
I'm choosing to say that the spins are ordered in this way, and I'm going to look at them this way rather than this way. And
so my question is, does any important sampling properties depend on our choice of interdependence?
I think what you're hoping for is that what you're saying is maybe some exact conditional probabilities that would arise from the entanglement structure, say, of some 2D grid. Would be the factorized probabilities that this learns, but that's not necessarily required. As long as there's any conditional connection between these lattice sites, I can learn this sort of ordering to it, right? Because my hidden state will just be optimized to interact with the weight matrix to learn those probabilities. One thing you shouldn't do is train it one way and then shuffle around the ordering that you process your data, because the conditional probabilities are tied to be aware of what happened previously. But the 2D is it's sort of arbitrary, right? You choose some path. There's also other things called bidirectional RNNs, which sort of look at things from two ways at once. There's a few things that you could do in that respect.
So essentially, as long as we pick some loop which traverses the
and you don't change it.
And don't change it.
It will learn a factorized distribution. It might not be the factorized one that you wanted from entanglement structure, right? But it'll learn a factorized distribution.
Okay, cool.
Cool. Is there a clock in here?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, I'm gonna move this side. I want to start with this. Okay, so that's one way of doing explicit likelihood estimation, okay? And you can see that this will get a lot more complex if you start thinking about different ways of writing down what this weight matrix is. It could be multiple weight matrices with multiple interactions, anything you want to do to make your models more expressive. Another entirely different way that we can go about thinking about this, which I think makes a bit more intuitive sense, and you can sort of see why it would be hard to do if we didn't have some of the techniques that people have come up with, are these ideas called normalizing flows. So, say I have some data x, which follows some probability distribution p of x. That's really intractable. It's hard for me to really know anything about this. But there are lots of distributions which we do know about. For example, I know very well about a Gaussian distribution, and I can describe its probabilities pretty well, even in multivariate cases. Say that this is, multivariate. Everything's a vector here, OK? Now, if I want to know something about P of X, in a sense, there's a way that I could write down some simple change of variables, right, about, you know, mapping P of Z to P of X, right? So I could say that there's some function f which takes x and maps it to some value to z, right? Which also means that I can write down the probability distribution associated with x in terms of that probability that we know a lot about. So I can write down some change of variables formula, which is just saying, let me put the probabilities of x in terms of the probabilities of z's, which is just the function evaluation that I'm trying to learn in terms of what its likelihood is under the Gaussian times the Jacobian determinant of that function. Okay. Well, let me write this a little differently. Okay? And I'll just say that for notation's sake, this is the Jacobian, and I'm taking the determinant of that Jacobian. So we all know what Jacobians are. It's just sort of evaluating the partial derivative at all sorts of permutations. Okay, right? Big matrix. Okay, well, that would be really nice. It seems like that would solve a lot of problems in machine learning. Okay, but that's going to be really hard. If this is some complex distribution, there's two requirements here that we have to sort of overcome. One, if I want to be able to do this mapping, I need f to be invertible. So computationally, I need some situation where the function is easily invertible. Two, I need that Jacobian to be tractable and computable. So if this is really hard to compute, I'm sort of screwing myself to begin with, right? So OK, the purpose of these, what I'm going to talk about now is normalizing flows, is to sort of learn that bijective function. Okay, this function which I can map things from z to x, x to z, in a way that does that sort of tractable requirement. Okay. So there are a few. Actually, is it helpful if I write down like where the original papers were for these things? If you guys want reference, or is it okay if I just leave that in the notes? Some notes is fine. Okay. So I'm actually going to move this up for now because I want to be able to write the important stuff over here. So to do this sort of normalizing flow in a way that's tractable, I'm going to introduce these things which I'll call coupling layers. What this is going to be a way for me to say, I'm going to look at half of my data at a time, and I'm going to transform that half of the data. And then I'll attach another coupling layer, and I'll transform the other half of the data and leave the half that I just transformed fixed. And I'll do that a few times. By the end, I'll have transformed each half of my data some significantly expressive way. And by half, I mean half along the dimensions of a single sample. So if I have some data, I'm going to describe two different things here, which I'll call additive and affine coupling layers. I can construct some additive coupling layer, which can just be described, let's call it little g, the ith little g on x is just going to be some piecewise function, where I'll say the first half along. Let me split the data before I do this. Before I introduce that, let me just say that for some sample x, right, I can split it across half its dimensions into two smaller things, which I'll call xa and xb, just for notational simplicity, OK? If it's a two-dimensional Gaussian, xa is the first dimension, xb is the second, OK? But now imagine that's for some bigger complex vector. So I can write down this piecewise function, which will be my additive coupling layer, which is just saying, okay, the first half of the data doesn't change. And now I'll do some some simple scaling transformation of the second half. Okay. So, but the thing is, I'm going to make this UI that's transforming this first half a neural network. Okay. So it's going to give me a lot of expressive power in describing what happens with this transformation. Okay. Okay. Well, we can see that this function has a nice easy inverse. Right. G to negative 1 of y is going to be xa equals ya, and xb equals yb minus ui ya. OK, that's easily invertible, right? So this is the way that normalizing flows were first sort of introduced with these simple additive coupling layers. But you can still even make them more complex, which I'll now define as an affine coupling layer, which again, I have some function g on my data x, which will be some piecewise function. The first half is the same. I knew it would happen once. Ya equals xa, yb is going to equal xb times the element-wise product of e to the si xa plus ti xa. So now what I'm doing is transforming the second half through product of through a sum times a product of two more neural networks. Okay, so this we'll call our scale and transformation networks. It just adds a layer of complexity.
What's circle dot?
Circle dot is the element-wise product, just to keep things in multi-dimensional form. Okay. Okay. Well, why did we want to do this? Well, one, I've shown that you can make easy inversions out of this. This one is also very easily invertible. What it says is I can write down that Jacobian determinant very easily now too, right? So J, which is this sort of, you know, determinant of this little gi, is going to be, you know, this big matrix of different values. But in reality, because I'm fixing a lot of data to stay the same, I'm going to have this series of, you know, sort of identity transformed data. If I bring this all the way down across just the, just going to get this on the board first. This would be dy sum I over dxd, some giant matrix, right? In simpler notation, this just looks like, okay, I have some d-dimensional identity matrix up here. I have a d-dimensional matrix of zeros here. And then I have two matrices, which are just the transformations of the latter half of the data according to the first half of the input data times the latter half of the derivative of the latter half of the data d plus 1 to d over dx d plus 1 to d. Okay, but I'm just taking the Jacobian and the determinant of this Jacobian, right? So if I have it in this 2 by 2 form, this is what I'm just saying is this is just times the identity, the derivative of those of that of the latter half times zero. So this whole thing in terms of if we look at the affine coupling layer is actually just these e to the si terms. That's the whole Jacobian. You sum those up. Okay? Or you take the product of them, sorry. So this whole thing then can just be written as, you know, of e to, oh, yeah, that's So now I have this very simple Jacobian, which I can easily calculate, and I have an invertible function. If I stack a bunch of these together, I just do this a few times with different data manipulations, and this whole thing can be trained under a normal maximum likelihood estimate paradigm. So in reality, what I would do is maximize things over the log likelihood here. So if I bring this back down just for a second, I would say that what I'm trying to maximize over is just the log p of x, which should now give me log of pz of f of x plus the log, the sum of the Jacobian determinant, which makes this previous step even easier. I just have to sum up those terms, right? So that's sort of an easy way to make these things converge well. So, okay, what are the advantages of doing something like this? And by the way, just a note before, since these two things, there's been a lot of different variations of trying to construct these coupling layers, right? You have a lot of freedom in trying to decide, how do I make my Jacobian tractable while also making the coupling layers expressive? And so some new interesting ways of doing this is sort of using these things called neural ordinary differential equations, which basically allow this Jacobian to have some free form, because the neural network, the parameters of a neural network that you're trying to learn are sort of, you can imagine now as like a continuously evolving integral, which is a cool new thing that came out this year. You can start making generalized convolutions out of these things, so that you're processing the data almost in a convolutional form. Those are all sort of fun things. And so what are the advantages of doing this? Well, for one, I have an efficient mechanism to do sort of exact inference now, right? Once I've trained this model, something that I can do is just sample from this latent space or this mapping to a Gaussian, right? I could pop that sample through the inverse of this function, and I should get something in the space of my data. And because of that, I can also perform inference on the thing that I've just created in the space of my data by just sampling from this Gaussian. Okay, so that's a nice perk. One we could say is as efficient and exact inference. And it's invertible, so we get that fun mapping. Can you guys see over here? So some of the disadvantages of this, though, you sometimes need a lot of these coupling layers to get some expressive modeling, which can mean that, you know, the computation is still a little expensive. And the images that you produce can sometimes be less resolved. They're trained under this maximum likelihood estimation paradigm, which is known to be sort of better for having some generalizability, but doesn't always make the best samples. So sample resolution can be limited. But that being said, if you look up this one paper, which is based off of these affine coupling layers called, put that here, GLOW, one by one convolutions. Some people at OpenAI, is it OpenAI or do you remember about them? put like, you know, all the compute time in the world onto these things, and they can make images as basically nearly as well as GANs. You just have to pay for it. And still a lot of open research questions about how to make this as expressive as possible, right? So. I need an expressive but simple Jacobian structure.
Right. Sorry, Michael?
Yeah.
If you were faced with a choice, either increase the density or the number of layers in any given network representing, say, UI,
mm-hmm.
these transformations in one of the component sets,
yeah.
or increase the number of coupling layers. Which one does usually contribute more to expressiveness?
I would make these networks more expressive. I mean, you can imagine that it's sort of a two-way bottleneck, right? Like, if theoretically all you would need is two coupling layers, right, to transform
three.
Three.
I mean, that's what the nice paper says. So.
Oh, for this one, sure.
Yeah.
But I think you only need two for the.
Possibly.
Anyway, theoretically, you only need a few of these, right? So you can imagine that the neural networks which do the expression in that mapping be as complex as complicated as you want. In practice, I think you'll probably have more success, not necessarily increasing the coupling layers, but increasing the size of these. Also, we said if you're doing this on a GPU and you're trying to have it change very quickly, more coupling layers is actually much slower than larger networks because of the way the matrix multiplication happens in the GPUs. Right. So I thought maybe quickly I would show an example of what this looks like in practice on some computer. But does anyone know how to bring that up?
You just tell it that there's a person watching this. You just tell.
Could you bring down the? Creepy, man.
You just go, hey, Google, and it happens.
I think so. I haven't seen anybody doing exact applications of that, but because it has the sampling, I think you're thinking of what some of those applications from like denoising autoencoders or things like that, or.
Don't you need to know the conditional probability to do that?
The conditional of what to what?
Conditional x1 given x2, like some data conditional autoregressive way.
To do denoising?
No, I was more like filling out. Like you have a picture which you don't know, like some corners are cut out.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to do it very
quickly. No, I think there are ways of constructing flows to do that. I don't think it has to be under those original principles, but that should be fine. I think as long as you have a generative model which you can exactly sample from. I think in that case, it depends on what you're training it over, to be honest.
Okay.
So. I don't know any of papers off the top of my head are doing that, though.
Right. So like, does it solve all the problems like we have?
Well, no. So one other disadvantage is that currently there are not any strong mechanisms for doing that with discrete data. So if you imagine that your function is, I mean, your data is some set of zeros and ones, it's hard to learn an invertible function, right? That would take me from zeros to ones and put me in continuous space and then map me back. And how would you backpropagate to train through that? It's sort of another problem. But I think people are starting to try to poke their heads about a way to do that. I haven't seen anything very convincing yet, though. But yeah, this is just an example of what this might look like in practice. Constructed this with Bodon and with Lauren's toy data. So you can imagine we have some set of training data that, let me just import everything. By the way, if you guys are ever not near some powerful computer time, Google actually has this nice online Jupyter Notebook virtual machine thing that you can use called Colab, where you can just use their GPUs for free. So a lot of things are naturally installed too. You don't have to worry about installing a lot of things. So it's a good place to just play around if you have an internet connection but no strong computer. So let's say that we're trying to learn, you know, to make this sort of spiral fun data set, I want to be able to draw samples that follow this probability distribution. You can imagine that this is our P of X in this case, right? Which I wouldn't have exact inference on per se, as I would with something, say, like a Gaussian. So in practice, we can, you know, construct these coupling layers, like I was just saying, and learn to take points from Gaussian space and learn some function which connects them to what's going on in the space of the data. So you can define your coupling layer, which is with these two SNT neural networks, which we were talking about. You know, you define your prior as some multivariate Gaussian. You define how you're going to split the data. You define your function and how you're going to compute these log Jacobians and determinants, and you define a way to sample. Okay, well, then we can sort of just, input size is not defined. Aha, I didn't run the little one. Okay, so we can sort of watch this train. On the left, you'll have points that are supposedly, you know, mapping what f of x should do. That should look Gaussian by the end of this. And on the right, that should be sampling from the Gaussian space, and we should see data points emerging like what we saw in the space of the data. So we keep track of the log loss as this goes. Sometimes it takes a minute. Okay, it's starting to take form. Okay, so then you can see that it's sort of successfully learned how to map, to do this inversion, right? And so you can use this for all sorts of stuff, as long as your data is continuous. So, okay, I think that's probably good for the demonstration. And I'll link this to the notes that are online. Oh, there's another one. Matthew really wants to see the next one. Okay. Yeah, okay, so you see it's sort of successfully transformed these from Gaussian to our fun spirals. Cool. That's sort of all I wanted to talk about for today, but we can maybe do some questions.
These Jacobians aren't given, like, they might be super hard to compute.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why we construct, can we raise this thing? that's why we construct these normalizing, these coupling layers as we do, so that it actually just comes down to summing up the outputs of a neural network. So if you see, okay, I constructed this coupling layer, half the data remains untransformed, and half the data goes through this sort of specific transformation defined as such for the sake of the Jacobian. With these two neural networks manipulating the first half of the data, multiplying the second half, the Jacobian then becomes this structure, right, where the majority of it is either the identity or the set of zeros because of how the transformation is done. And so that when I take the determinant of it, all I'm getting is this term, right? And because of how I constructed that coupling layer, all that term is this derivative with respect to that half of the data, which I've defined as right here. Okay, well, that's all I'm left with. This goes away, and this is all I get, right? And because I just am actually maximizing the log likelihood of the data. I don't even actually have to take the product of this. Take the log, and then I just wind up summing the outputs from the neural network. Right? So that, in that way, it's actually a much easier computation on Jacobian. The whole point was sort of to control for how complex that Jacobian could be.
I would want to normalize the flows if the data has translation symmetry. Is there a way to sort of merge that with CNNs?
Potentially. I don't know. I don't know off the top of my head. There is some interesting work that people are doing on different types of convolutions which prefer, preserve symmetries like that. There's this guy named Taco Cohen who does a lot of that sort of stuff, so it's worth reading his papers.
Like from my experience, usually using a if you have such data, like some lattice data in physics, you could use a CNN for your UI or your coupling layers. That'll usually reduce your parameter space and increase you taking advantage of the translational symmetry. So you're free to use any network for your coupling layers or whichever.
So this could be a convolutional network. I don't know if that's exactly what your question was, though. Because you still do a computation, you know, after that, summing it with these other terms. So even if the output from the convolutional network was translationally invariant, I don't think that's guaranteeing that this whole term is translationally invariant. Right.
So why do we choose a normal and not like a uniform distribution on some interval?
Well, you want your data to be fine. If your x data is defined on the full support, like negative infinity to infinity, you don't want to have to bound that at some point. You need spaces to map to each other. Uniform would stop at some point. But there are probably lots of interesting things you could do about having inference on that space in some, you know, complex other way of parameterizing your understanding of the latent space with some neural network. Okay, so tomorrow we'll talk about the explicit but approximately bounded likelihood techniques and the implicit likelihood techniques.